It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Hey, friends. This is Michael Brown. So I'm here now just to answer your questions. Many of you are unable to call in. You're in different parts of the world. You can't call in during work or other things. So post your questions right here on Facebook. Anything under the sun you want to ask me, I'll get to as many as possible. Everyone listening on the radio, this is not a day to call. This is a day to sit back and enjoy the broadcast as I interact with questions that are being posted on the Ask Dr. Brown Facebook page. So ask away any question of any kind, and I'll do my best to answer as many as possible. So just glad to see some folks tuning in from different locations. That's one cool thing with doing this on Facebook or YouTube. You can see where people are joining you from. Everyone listening on radio, I know you're out there, just don't know exactly where you always are. Grace, how can you know whether if something you've been praying for a long time, 14 years, is God delaying for the right time or if he's saying no? Grace, I would say this, that if the burden continues in your heart, if you continue when you're really in fellowship with the Lord to have this burden come up within you, then you should keep praying accordingly. Look, there are things that we ask for and we keep asking for them and they're not God's will. And graciously, he's not answering that prayer because it's not in our best interest. But many other times, good things take time. Or we're praying for other people's lives and things have to happen in their lives. Or God's forming things in us or waiting for us to get to a certain point in life where we're ready to take that step. So for me, there are many things I've prayed about over the years and I've put aside and thought, ah, maybe it wasn't really the Lord. Maybe I was just praying out of my own burden. But then it keeps coming back up, and it comes up when I'm really meeting with the Lord and really in quality fellowship with the Lord. It comes up again, so I trust that's from the Lord. Again, some of the most critically important things in my life were things that were prayed for years and years and years, and there are yet things ahead by God's grace that I'm looking forward to that I have been praying for decades and have not seen the fullness of the answer yet. So if the burden stays with you, by all means, keep praying. Ronald, what in my mind is the best argument against preterism? So preterism, the idea, let's say full preterism, that all of the future prophecies about the second coming of Jesus, the prophecies about what he'll do with his return, that they were fulfilled with the destruction of the temple in the year 70. I would say that some of the strongest arguments against preterism, and again, we're talking full preterism, which I find to be dangerously wrong in many ways, that you have explicit things spoken of in Scripture. The resurrection of our bodies when Jesus returns. I debated a full preterist that said, no, that's spiritual and already happened. That's scary to me. So the clear prophecies, the new heaven and the new earth, look at the end of Revelation 21 and 22, and the explicit things that will happen, and no more war or pain or sighing or tears, and everything that's going to unfold, that clearly, definitely has not yet happened. And therefore, it, to me, demolishes the full preterist view. Now, you might be a full preterist and say, well, I'm not nuancing it properly. Well, I'm obviously differing with it. Someone just sent me a book. I haven't gone through it in detail yet, Refuting Preterism. I'm going to look at it, and if I feel it does what I want to do, then great, I'll recommend that book. Otherwise, I'll recommend it. And still, I want to write a book, Refuting Preterism. And I'm seeing numbers of people get into it, and it's negatively affecting their spiritual lives, and that's a great concern for sure. All right, Starlet, what are my views about the rapture? Professor Craig Keener and I have a book due out next year called Not Afraid of the Antichrist, Why We Don't Believe in a Pre-Trib Rapture. Whether the tribulation period is a specific seven-year period in the future or whether the tribulation period is from the death of Jesus on the cross until his return, in other words, that we're in tribulation all these centuries, either way, we will be here until the end. I do not believe in a pre-trib or mid-trib rapture. Rather, Jesus returns in a public glorious event that the whole world sees. We are caught up to meet him and glorified and descend to earth together with him. All right, let's see. Natalie also asked about the rapture. Do I think that dinosaurs are Bible dragons? Okay, there's no question that dinosaurs existed. If you are a young earth creationist, then you would say that dinosaurs existed at times when there were human beings on the earth, and that this can be demonstrated in different ways. And there's now evidence that the dinosaurs are not as old as others say. If you're an old earth, first you say, no, the dinosaurs were here way before the time of human beings. The Taninim are spoken of in Genesis 1, you know, the sea creatures. Does that allude to dinosaurs there? The creatures at the end of the book of Job, Behemoth and Leviathan, some say it's hippopotamus and crocodiles. Some say that they're demonic spiritual beings. Others say that they're dinosaurs. Let's say this. If the young earth creationists are true, then those could well refer to dinosaurs, who also were looked at as dark spiritual beings as well. And people had the memory of them. They would ostensibly have been wiped out with the flood. But otherwise, if young earth creationists are not accurate in their understanding of things, then I would not understand these verses to be speaking about dinosaurs. All right, let's see. So other question from Natalie. I'll make it the last from Natalie. How old do I think the world is? I'm not sure. Scripturally, I could easily see young earth creation being right. There are other passages that point in directions where I could see old earth creation being right. I personally don't know. I do not have the scientific acumen to interact with scholars on both sides of the argument. This much I will tell you. I completely reject this whole flat earth nonsense that's going around these days. Okay, Julio, how does the Passover relate to Christ? What are some Jewish objections to the Christian perspective of it being a foreshadowing of Christ? Well, from a Jewish perspective, it's got a traditional Jewish perspective, nothing to do with Jesus. It's the exodus of the children of Israel from Egypt. The sacrificing of the lamb, they would say, was not, you know, vicarious sacrifice or atoning sacrifice, and it was a lamb, not a man. So, you know, traditional Judaism would see no point of reference to it there at all. However, we see many points of reference. We recognize that Jesus came into this world as a Passover lamb. We recognize that his purpose was not to rule and reign as a king, but to lay his life down and die. We recognize that by the shedding of his blood, we are delivered from the penalty of sin and death. We recognize that we are brought out of a greater bondage than Egypt. So we do see those parallels, the importance of the blood. And even in Genesis 22, when Abraham tells Isaac that God will provide a lamb for the offering, which is actually a ram, not a lamb. So where is the lamb? We say it is the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world, John 1:29. And of course, we know that Jesus has the Last Supper. This is the day on which, the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, this is the day on which the Passover lambs are sacrificed. And then that's when he is now going to be betrayed and go to the cross. All right, let's see. Mario, I have a friend that is married to a non-believer. They clash often about finances, parenting, and their own marriage. Is refusal from his wife to go to church and Christian counseling for years grounds for a divorce? Technically, she's being unfaithful to God. Oh, no. It is his role and calling to win her over. As long as she is content to stay, then it is his sacred calling to seek to win her to the Lord. Paul addresses this in 1 Corinthians 7. If the non-believer wants to stay, then they stay. And Paul says, how do you know? How do you know that you might not be the one to save your wife or save your husband? Now, here's another point. If the relationship becomes absolutely insufferable, if there is daily conflict and it's miserable for the kids and everything is falling apart and there is an agreement to separate and they feel, look, we just need to separate, that may be something that they come to, but that's not grounds for divorce and certainly not for remarriage. Marriage is for life, whether it's hard or not. And you say she's unfaithful to God. That's not the issue. She doesn't know the Lord, and it's his sacred responsibility to be a Christ-like husband. And in the challenge of living with a woman who may be hostile to God, this is his opportunity to grow and even model a Christian response for the kids. Patrick, What do you feel like your church doesn't, what if you feel like your church doesn't feel a sense of community, like people would rather interact with the people they know than new people? That's human nature, Patrick. It's human nature that you hang out with the people that you're friendly with. You know, you do events, birthday and special times of the year with family. You go out to eat with your friends. You do things together with the people you're close to. What's important, though, is that the church recognizes that it has a mission. And the best way to do it is if on a regular basis you talk about reaching the lost and then praying for them. Finney said if you pray regularly for the lost, you'll get a burden for them. And now when people start coming in or new people start coming in, you've been praying for them. When they walk in the door, you're thrilled to see them. I don't mean you're necessarily praying for them by name, but you've been praying for new people. You've maybe been praying for young people, for old people, for lost people. They come walking in through your doors. You're excited to see them. And then when you start to deal with people with new problems, new issues, and see their lives change, it's invigorating. And especially people getting saved, it's often said that souls, new souls, are the lifeblood of the church. And now somebody that was a stranger when they came in 2 months ago is born again and now giving their testimony at baptism and everyone's shouting for joy. Then it gets that sense of outreach, 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 outreach. When it becomes part of your lifestyle, part of your burden. Again, it's very natural to want to spend all the time with folks you know, but when you start having that mentality of reaching out, it produces this wonderful cycle of life. All right, got a minute and a half before my first break. Kevin, what is my view on baptism after backsliding? Is it recommended? What if the person's been away from God for over 20 years? My understanding over the years used to be that you're baptized once you're born again, and there's one baptism, and that's it, period. And if you come back to the Lord, that you come back and you're forgiven and you renew that love relationship with him and a relationship of obedience to the Lord, but you don't get baptized again. However, I've seen people come back to God and they felt like this was more real than when they got saved and they had more understanding now and they wanted to freshly dedicate their lives to God and therefore were baptized a second time. Does God despise that? Does God have a doctrinal rigidness where he says, that's wrong? Or does he appreciate that devotion? So I've seen it be very, very powerful in people's lives. The only thing is you don't want to have somewhere now I'm baptized for the 11th time because I keep coming back to the Lord. Obviously, that's unhealthy. But a situation like this, someone's been away from the Lord for decades, and they come back and they feel like it's just like it's a fresh start. As long as they understand that it's the same blood that was shed for them and that God's forgiveness and mercy is there, it could be very powerful. All right. We're taking a momentary break, and then we will be right back answering your Facebook questions today. God of light,
hear our cry. Send the fire. It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
All right, I want to take your Facebook questions now for a few minutes. We're not going to be taking phone calls, but I'm going to be responding to your questions posted on Facebook, as many as I can get to in the next few minutes. This is Michael Brown, and a special edition of The Line of Fire. I've often been asked about my views on the rapture, mentioned that Professor Craig Keener and I have a book for popular audience, not for scholarly audience, on why we don't believe in the pre-trib rapture called Not Afraid of the Antichrist, which comes out next year, God willing. So one question, if we're here during the last 7 years, how do we escape the wrath of God that Paul clearly says is not appointed to us? Number one, when he writes to the Thessalonians and says you're not appointed for wrath, but for salvation, he's not talking about a tribulation, he's talking about eternity. All right, we're not going to be punished by the wrath of God, but how did God protect Israel when he poured out his judgments on Egypt? Yeah, they were right there, and yet he protected them. Go to Ezekiel, the 9th chapter. There were righteous people in Jerusalem when the Babylonians came through to destroy. God put a mark on them, and they were spared when others were destroyed. God can keep us from his wrath right in the midst of wrath being poured out. And that has always been the way he has worked, over and over and over. So, yes, we will be protected by God from his wrath. But the wrath of man, the wrath of Satan are always going to be here. And is the Antichrist going to kill Christians worse than they're being killed now, torture them worse than they're being tortured now? Jesus said, in this world, you'll have tribulation. John 16, John 17, he says, I'm not praying, God, that you'll take them out of the world. So we'll be in this world, there will be tribulation and suffering, but we will overcome in Jesus. Debate Stephen Anderson. Stephen Anderson's anti-Semitic comments are so ugly, and his statements regarding homosexuals so ugly, that I'm not eager to dignify some of these with a debate, nor do I feel there's anything really worthy of debating. It's something I'd consider, but I don't even want to give exposure to some of these views, which I find to be very foul. All right, let's just see here. Do I think the Antichrist is alive today and is a political world leader? I have no idea. I have zero idea. I don't really think about it, to be honest. I'm looking for Jesus. I'm looking for the Christ, not for the Antichrist. And yes, I expect there'll be great deception, but we follow the principles that God's called us to follow, and we won't be deceived. But is he here? I don't know. I do know 1 John 2 says already, we know it's the last hour, and there are many Antichrists, and that was 2,000 years ago. So yes, there will be the Antichrist in the future. I believe that. But is he here now? Is he a political world leader, religious leader? I have no idea. I'll say this. I don't see anyone that's a candidate. Now, things could change overnight, but there's no one I'm looking at right now on the world scene and saying, oh, that person is clearly, you know, an Antichrist kind of type of candidate. You know, I don't see any political leader, religious leader that has that scope, that sway, that influence that I could look at and say, yeah, that's the person. Let's see here. Just looking at some other questions. If in Revelation 13, all the world follows the Antichrist, then who is left to rapture, or are we all executed? Okay. If you believe in a pre-trib rapture, you believe that during the Great Tribulation, that massive numbers of people will get saved, right? That you believe there are 144,000 Jews that are going to get saved. You believe there's going to be a multitude that no one can number that gets saved. Revelation, the seventh chapter. So, for sure, you don't believe when it says all the world follows them that it means every single human being on the planet. Rather, the whole world, it's, you know, all nations and classes and things like that. That's how I'd understand it, because we know in the midst of it, there are believers here throughout. Even with a pre-trib view, there are many, many people getting saved during the tribulation and then dying for their faith, all right? So no one would believe that there's no one here that is a believer anymore. Let's see. What's my response to Dr. White's argument that none will be able to stand at the pit of hell yelling, I have undone God's salvific work in regard to perseverance of the saints? Okay. For sure. And let me make this plain so everyone understands. I have much in harmony with Calvinistic views and then clear differences with Calvinistic views. So Calvinism teaches P, perseverance of the saints, in the TULIP acronym. So T stands for total depravity, U, unconditional election, L, limited atonement, I, irresistible grace, P, perseverance of the saints. Calvinists do not teach what is often called once saved, always saved, meaning once you get saved, no matter how you live, no matter how far you fall from God, no matter how much sin you commit, no matter how many times you deny Jesus, you're not saved. You can't be lost. You're still saved. Calvinists don't teach that. Calvinists say if you die in your sin, then you were never truly saved. So they teach perseverance of the saints, namely that those whom God has called to salvation will persevere in holiness till the end. And if they backslide, it will only be temporary and they will return to the faith. So it is not a cheap thing to me, like once saved, always saved can be cheap, but I don't agree with it for a number of reasons. First, I see the warnings in the New Testament as very real. I see the ifs and the conditions and the warnings in books like Hebrews, say Hebrews chapter 2, chapter 3, chapter 4, chapter 10, chapter 12. Very strong warnings. I take those as serious, that we indeed can forfeit our salvation. When Jesus speaks to some believers, I'll never blot your name out of the book of life, it's telling me that others could have their names blotted out. When I see passages in 2 Peter that for some who knew the Lord, knew, came to the knowledge of the Lord Jesus, then turned away, it was better for them that they never knew. That's telling me that they can turn away and that the fate is worse. So I believe in God's keeping power. I rest in it. I never worry about losing my salvation because I've entrusted my life to the Lord, and he who began the good work will bring it to completion. I believe that. But he is not forcing me to stay. Someone can forfeit their salvation as I understand scripture. What's the unforgivable sin? If you're talking about the one thing that Jesus says, for example, Mark 3, is unforgivable, it is blasphemy of the Spirit. Now, what is blasphemy of the Spirit? Is blasphemy of the Spirit the utter rejection of Jesus, and when I completely and utterly reject him, that's unforgivable? Well, Jesus says in the same context that every sin committed against the Father, against the Son, that these will be forgiven, meaning if we come and repent through the blood, says, for example, they will be forgiven. However, it is blasphemy. And by the way, guys, don't know what happened. All right, just had a feed of me in my ear there for a second. Okay, so he does say that other sins that have been committed can be forgiven. All right, but the blasphemy of the Spirit cannot be forgiven. In context, in Mark 3, it is knowingly attributing the works of the Holy Spirit to Satan. Because Jesus is performing miracles by the Spirit, and the religious leaders are saying he has a demon. He's doing it by the power of Satan. These were people who knew better. These were people who had come to such a point of hardness of heart that they were now willingly attributing the works of the Holy Spirit to Satan. That I understand to be the unforgivable sin. Now look, some years ago, there was this whole YouTube video move where people were getting online and saying, I blaspheme the Spirit, and even little children doing it, and people were, quote, deconverting and doing it. And they were mocking this and saying, okay, we're committing the unforgivable sin. And as I watched some of them with grief in my heart, I thought, you know, we're going to be watching videos from some of them in a few years saying, I was one of those people. I was so ignorant. I was so lost. I did this, but God had mercy on me and forgave me. And in other words, it was done in ignorance. Paul says in 1 Timothy 1 that God had mercy on him when he was persecuting believers because he acted in ignorance and unbelief. Let's see here. How does penal substitution work in light of Jesus not suffering in hell for eternity? Okay, penal substitution is saying that Jesus paid the penalty for our sin by dying on the cross, that it is substitutionary atonement. It is not implying that Jesus felt and experienced in every way everything that we would experience with the guilt of sin for the entire human race, but it is the representative penalty. It's the penalty of death. It is the penalty of guilt, and it is the penalty of taking our sins and thereby experiencing God's judgment as he hangs on the cross. Now, there are some who believe that while hanging on the cross, he experienced what would be the pangs of hell. Or he experienced the feeling of lostness and separation. Others would say, look, but his next words, you know, before he dies, are, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. So he's obviously always in fellowship with his Father. There's some, though, who believe that he experienced, as I say, the pangs of hell hanging on the cross. Hell is the result of us rejecting the Lord. And because we are created in his image and we are created to go on living, that now we are going to be sent away from him in separation, and that is the consequence of it, hell prepared for the devil and his angels, as Jesus says in Matthew 25. But it's Jesus, the penalty for sin is death, and Jesus, by dying on the cross, pays for our sins. Let's see here. I got time for one more question. Is schizophrenia an illness or demonic possession? It could be either. We know for sure that there are cases where someone is medically diagnosed as schizophrenic, and you can actually see things on the brain, as I understand it, where you understand that there is something malfunctioning here. And then sometimes with medication, it can be modified, just talking in the natural here without God's intervention. At other times, there is no physical, biological, mental explanation for schizophrenia. It is someone who is tormented by a demon. So if you have someone where there is no medical explanation and no counseling explanation for this, and the torment is real, it could be demonic power. But you don't want to be trying to drive demons out of someone that's not demonized. And at the same time, medicine is not going to cure a demon. So we need to understand what we are dealing with. All right, friends, more questions, you can always send them my way via the website, askdrbrown.org, askdrbrown.org. www.facebook.com/thelineoffire.org. Just want to take a few minutes and answer some of your Facebook questions today.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Hey, friends, I've got a very special guest today on The Line of Fire. He has played in the NFL the last 9 years. He's a man that's actually made a positive impact on our two grandsons, who are both 14 years old now. And he's written a great little book. I liked it so much, I asked him to send a signed copy to one of my grandkids, the other grandkid he met face to face when we were invited to go to a game, watch him play. I actually got to speak to many of his teammates at a chapel service. His name is Don Carey. The book, It's Not Because I'm Better Than You. And Don is a man who really loves the Lord and is more serious about Jesus than anything around him. And he's got some great things to say, especially to the younger generation. Hey, Don, great to have you on The Line of Fire today.
Well, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
You know, we first connected when you responded to an open letter that I wrote to NFL players, encouraging them to sit out, threatened to sit out games if the league continued to use them as pawns in the culture wars. And you said, hey, listen, I'm more serious about the Lord than my NFL career. That really impressed me. How is it that God did such a deep work in your life? Were you raised in a godly home, Don?
Yes, I was. I was raised by my mother and my stepdad. They're both deeply devoted Christians, and they always raised us to be unapologetic in our faith. So I try to walk that out every single day.
Now, what about your biological father? What happened with him?
Sure. So when I was around 3 years old, my biological father was introduced to cocaine by his dad. Mm. And it led him down a path of being a career felon and crack addict pretty much most of my life. He's currently in jail now. But you know what? Through the grace of God, we've been able to reconcile, you know, our differences, and we speak almost every other day.
Really? Really?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So you had, in that sense, a major strike against you, but then your stepdad raising you in the faith along with your mom. What about, though, as you now start to get into the world of athletics and now even get into the NFL, is there a conflict between the world of sports and having every dream at your fingertips, so to say, and following Jesus?
No, I don't think so. It really boils down to the lifestyle you're committed to living. Mm-hmm. Right. So if you're in the NFL and you're committed to living a Christian life, it's available for you. If you're in the NFL and you're committed to living a life where you're going out partying and doing what all those things, it's available to you. So in that sense, we're no different than anyone else. You know, we have to make decisions every single day. Are we going to follow Jesus, or are we going to let our sinful convictions take over?
Got it. Now, you were not in an elite college, in an elite program, correct?
Correct, yes.
And what about your, I mean, to me, you're extraordinarily athletic, and be able to play in the NFL and play for 9 years is amazing. And when we went to the game, we couldn't believe, even though you're not the youngest player on the field, that you were the first guy down making tackles. My grandson, I said, how does he do it? But you had to work at certain things, and that's what your book is about. It's not because I'm better than you. So tell me about the college program you're in, and then how it is that you ended up in the NFL.
Sure. So I went to Norfolk State University. It's a HBCU, historically black college and university here in Norfolk, Virginia. And, you know, going there is a struggle because they hadn't seen an individual make it to the NFL since 1996. Mm. So we didn't have a constant example of what it took to get there. But I had a drive and a work ethic that was actually instilled within me by my stepdad. When we first got to Virginia, he noticed that I was a kid who had potential, but I really lacked the discipline to get things done. And by him being a military man, he acted militarily, and he took my dresser, and he had me fold my clothes a certain way. He had me make my bed a certain way, and I had to set him under the windowsill, and he would check every single day. And the discipline I learned from him in my high school years really carried on to me at Norfolk State. I was able to outwork everybody, just to be very blunt. And it carries over to my book as well. If I can wrap my book up in one quote, it's from Thomas Edison, that says, most people miss opportunity because it's dressed in overalls and looks like work. Yeah. So I try to put as much inspiration as I can in the book. But the underlying message is you get what you work for.
All right. So to give this context, very few people know how hard athletes have to work, how hard professional athletes have to work, what it takes not just to get into the game, but to stay in the game and then to stay at an elite level. So say, for example, in your college days, what did you do to outwork the other guys that were in the program?
Sure. So I would routinely get up around 5 a.m. and go work out with the track team, weightlifting. And I did that because our weightlifting program was more geared towards power and strength, whereas the track team, they did things more of explosion and speed. So I wanted to make sure I got the totality of lifting to make me a more complete player. I would then go to classes, come back and fulfill my workouts with the football team on the field and in the weight room. And then I would spend time on the field just perfecting my craft. You know, I studied what it took to be a good corner, a good safety, and I put together a routine that I did every single day. And every single waking moment that I had, I was in my coach's office. We were watching film, trying to figure out how I can be just a little bit better. And I started to see my play get improve every single year, to the point where we played Rutgers my junior year. And I was able to lock down one of the nation's best receivers and really put myself on a map to the NFL.
All right. So again, the message of your book, it's not because I'm better than you. I'm speaking with Don Carey, 9-year veteran in the NFL. The whole message is that the same principles that work for you will work for anyone else in their lives. You know, it's the same ethic, the same hard work, the same extra effort put in, that this will produce dividends. So you make it into the NFL. And one of my favorite parts of the book is when you talk about, say, being on special teams, and you won awards for best special team player certain years. I mean, everything in the NFL is so specialized. So along with playing corner and safety, then did this as well. But you're talking about, say, on a punt return, and you're going to be playing on defense, trying to tackle the guy. What goes into it? And you're going to have two guys trying to stop you, and they're probably younger and stronger. So just paint a picture. It's in the book. It's not that I'm better than you, but paint a picture for our listeners of what goes into it, and then what kind of special training did you engage in to stay at your best?
Sure. So that's in the chapter entitled Autistic Focus, in which I say you really have to focus autistically at the smallest details. Similar to an individual with autism who can't help but to focus on the smallest details, we can learn from individuals in that community and make ourselves better. So on a typical punt play, you're walking onto the field, and teams attack a punt team different ways. So you really can get an idea of what they want to do based on the down and distance, based on what hash you're on, and based on where you are physically on the field. So as I'm running on the field, I'm looking at all those keys. And then next, when I get into my stance, I'm looking at who is across from me, because I know different players have different tendencies. Some guys like to be aggressive. Some guys like to play off and just run with you. And then I'm able to communicate rightly with my teammates at that point. And at the snap of the ball, I know that most of the time I have two individuals assigned to me in what's called a vice. And their sole purpose is to prevent me from getting down the field. And in order to give me the best chance of getting around these two guys, who, like I say in the book, are oftentimes younger, more athletic, and faster than myself, I have to make sure that I take the perfect steps, that my eyes are in the perfect spot, and that my hands are in the perfect spot to give me a shot. Now, when I do this rightly, I'm able to defeat these two guys and give me a shot at bringing down the returner. But when I do not do this rightly, it can be a long down, to say, put it lightly. But I've been able to perfect it to down to a science where I win more so than I do not. And it has nothing to do with my physical ability. I believe it has more to do with the fact that that play means more to me than the individual I'm going against. And I study and I work out more and I train in that moment more than a person that's across from me as well.
And you talk about training in the moment. So you'd actually work with teammates that would constantly put you in a difficult situation, and you would practice getting out of it. So it wasn't just the athleticism of the moment, but all the practice. And you even talked about how you had to do special hand exercises because you had to use your hands with these guys. So explain all this.
Sure. So the working with teammates was something different for our coaches. So every player is evaluated during the week in order to see who they're going to put on the field on Sunday. But I told my coach, hey, I need to work on specific things because there are certain situations that I'm in the game that we don't necessarily cover during the week. And they allowed me to do that. So I will put myself in the absolute worst position possible and then try to figure out ways to get out of it. And doing that during the week helped me when I got into the game because I was never surprised by anything, right? So whether things were going well for me as planned, awesome, but if things weren't, then I had a plan for that as well. And most people think that the NFL is all about upper body strength, bicep, tricep, chest, back, and it really is. But at the end of the day, it's grip strength. Having the ability to grab a grown man and snatch him off you is vitally important to being successful in the league. So I would put together different routines to make sure my grip strength was equally or more strong than my bicep and tricep and all those things. And I would really focus on it religiously every single day.
And friends, the book, It's Not Because I'm Better Than You, is getting rave reviews on Amazon. And I just noticed that the Kindle e-edition is on special sale. So you may want to pick that up. Don Carey says this: never let the words of others and social norms dictate the level of your significance, whether you work hard daily to show them why they need someone such as yourself. Don, when you came to the Detroit Lions, it was not the godliest team in the league. Some teams have more believers on the team than others. What happened when you got there? How did things change? We've got about 2 minutes before the break. How did things change in your time with the Lions?
When I first got there, there were a lot of individuals who were not believers, and the believers who were on the team kind of had the mindset that we're going to let the world be the world, and we're going to focus on, you know, living godly lives. And in some respect, I can understand that. But really, I just saw the Spirit of the Lord move, you know, by position group in that locker room. And really, when Coach Caldwell came to the team in 2014, he set an atmosphere where Christianity can really flourish in the locker room. Mm-hmm. And it grew to the point where our linebackers prayed after games. Our DBs prayed and read scriptures. We even read through the whole New Testament this past year.
Amazing.
Where players were able to pray before we went out to games and practice. We had more Bible studies, couple Bible studies. My wives had more Bible studies. It was just tremendous to see the power of God work.
Yeah, and I was there to speak to these guys and see how devoted and serious they were about the Lord. All right, we'll be right back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
He's written a great little book, It's Not Because I'm Better Than You. I really encourage you to get the book and to give it to your teenage kids. Read it yourself. You can be in leadership. You can be in ministry, and you'll profit by reading it. But in particular, get it to your teenage kids. Get it to young adults. Get it to young people and older people that are in athletics. You got to take it seriously when someone who's been a 9-year NFL vet talks to you. And Don, obviously only the tiniest percentage of kids that play football end up making it into the NFL. I mean, it's infinitesimally small. What percentage stick around for 9 years?
Oh, wow. Significantly smaller than that. So there have been around 26,000 players in the history of the NFL. Only 7,000 have made it past 5 years.
Wow.
And I believe you're getting to 700-800 have made it to year 9. So I'm in a unique category. I'm blessed to be here. But the funny thing is about college students, there are about 460,000 NCAA athletes. And one thing many of them fail to realize is every last one of them are going pro in something, but most are going pro in something other than sports, right? So you're going to be doctors, lawyers, businessmen. You're going to do so much right? And the thing I love about my book is it really carries over to other vocations as well, not just sports.
Yeah, absolutely. And when I'm telling to get into the hands of kids that are in sports, yes, but it's beyond that. That's why I said leadership, ministry, mm-hmm. as well, practical principles. It's not because I'm better than you. And again, it would be one thing if out of the womb you were one of those unique gifted athletes that, you know, when you're 7 years old, people are saying, man, you're going to be a famous sports star. But you're obviously an athletic kid, grew up. But the key thing is that you weren't better than everybody. And yet here you end up being in this tiny, tiny elite group that plays 9 years in the NFL. And the best thing of all, maintains a godly testimony in the midst of it. So Don, you've got a chapter in the book called The Deception of Talent. What do you get into there?
So I open up the book with the story of a young man at Norfolk State who came a few years after myself. I went back to talk to our coaches, and he was in there watching film. And the coach says, this kid has a real shot at making it to the NFL, similar to the way I did. And I began to give him, you know, some insight on what I had to do, how hard I had to work. And I can tell he was kind of brushing off my comments as if to say, that's what you had to do. I don't have to do that. And I can tell in his mind, it was, hey, that was for you. I'm talented enough to make it on my own. And it turned out that it didn't work out for him. He didn't get drafted. He was good enough to make a roster, but he didn't stick around, and he's not playing anymore. And from that, I gleaned that most people are more in depth to focus on their own talent than to sit back and look at the reality that is going to take more than your physical ability to make it to the highest echelon of whatever your career field is. And really, when you're in high school, you can be more talented than everybody else. But as you go to college, that talent disparity really evens out. And then when you get to the pros, every last, you know, individual there is talented. So there has to be something other than your God-given ability that gives you a shot at being great.
And you find that when you talk to young people and to folks in leadership or the business world, when you talk about these things, this is something that everybody relates to. It's not just athletes. What's going to separate you from someone else? Or if you feel called by God to ministry, what's going to separate you from someone else? What's going to enable you to live out the dreams that are inside of you? And throughout the book, one of the neatest features of the book, and it's because you're so well connected in sports, you've got great quotes from NFL players, from some NFL legends, from coaches, from other athletes. These quotes, what have they meant to you? It seems like these are quotes that have impacted you, and now you want to share them with others.
Well, firstly, the individuals in this book have had a profound impact on me. They've helped shape me into the man that I am today. Not just a player, but the man, and most of them are believers. So they've helped hold me accountable to the Christian faith when I play with them. So from that standpoint, I really appreciate them. But then their willingness to sow into the next generation, their heart to help someone, you know, get to that level of success, whatever they deem that to be, that also means a lot to me. And they have some powerful quotes in the book. Sometimes I just go through the book and read their quotes as inspiration for myself.
Share one of the quotes that has meant the most to you. You gave us in the first segment that great Thomas Edison quote. Share one that you got from a coach or another athlete that's really impacted you.
Sure. So there's a guy, Scott Starks, who always says, know thyself. Right. And he's been saying that since the day I met him. And by that, he means that you're unique. Every last one of us is unique. God has placed purpose inside of us. God has ordained us to do something. But you can never figure out who that person is. You can never fulfill that purpose if you don't spend time figuring out who you are and being comfortable with yourself. And Scotty is one of those people. He's always trying to pull the best you out of you. One example of that, my rookie year in the NFL, he would force me to stay back after practices just to work on things because he knew that I had more than what I was putting out. And that really permeated not just through me, but through other players that he would force to stick back as well, simply because he wanted us to have a good understanding of our strengths and our weaknesses. And he wanted us to be able to play the game of life in a way that maximized our strengths by minimizing our weaknesses. So it's quotes like that in the book that really had a profound impact.
And, you know, we all hear things like no pain, no gain. I've done, you know, I'm in my 60s, I'm 63 now. And I'll do workouts with our students, you know, just to try to push. And the one thing you realize, though, is that if you're really going to be set apart, I've never been a professional athlete or anything, but you got to push through the pain. And, you know, people hear you talk about the work effort and the extra effort, but in any area of life, there's going to have to be discipline. How did that become so foundational? You mentioned your stepdad raising you in your military way, but a lot of people just don't walk in discipline.
Yeah. On some level, there has to be some passion attached to whatever you're trying to do. The difference between passion and talent, when I speak to youth, I always tell them I'm a good bowler, right? I can bowl a 220, you know, on any given day, but I'm not willing to lose sleep over bowling. I'm not willing to miss a meal over bowling. I'm not willing to endure blood, sweat, tears, broken bones over bowling. Therefore, I'm not truly passionate about bowling. And the chances of me rising to the top, the upper echelon of success in that field, is very low. But when it comes to football, I've lost sleep over football. I've broken bones. I've cried blood, sweat, and tears. Mm-hmm. I've sacrificed time with my friends, my loved one, my children, my wife, to give me the best shot of being great. Therefore, the success that I see and the discipline that I can have in football is really to be expected based on the amount of work I've put into it. And when it comes to discipline, most people fail to realize that it takes 21 days before your body gets acclimated to something. And that's where most of us stop, thinking that it's a part of who we are. From that 21 days, you have to do that same thing 90 complete days before your body says, okay, this is a part of who you are, and you're able to complete that thing over and over again. The individuals who can last 90 days doing something religiously oftentimes find themselves being truly disciplined in that area.
Mm. You know, and I looked at some of those principles, even other folks you quoted in your book, which got me to reading other books and even looking at some of these things. Again, the book, It's Not Because I'm Better Than You, by Don Carey. Don, we've just got a couple minutes, but another chapter in the book, Marketing Yourself. What do you get into there?
Marketing yourself is I really wanted to help people focus on how they are perceived, right? So I give an example of a Wawa versus a Starbucks. Now, you can go into a Wawa and you can go to grab coffee. You can say hi to the person working at the counter, and they can be the best individuals you ever met. The coffee can be made perfectly. The individuals working there can have the greatest relationship. It can be clean. Or you can go into a Wawa and it'd be, you know, one of the dirtiest places you've been in. The individuals working there can be fussing and fighting. The coffee can't be cold because it was made early in the morning and no one maintained it. You just don't know what you're going to get when you walk into a Wawa. It's possible that it's the best Wawa in the world, but it's also possible that you will be utterly disgusted. Now, if you contrast that to a Starbucks has a level of consistency that you can expect regardless of where you are in the country. You know when you walk in that there's going to be free Wi-Fi. You know when you walk in that you're going to be greeted with a friendly hello by the person working at the counter. You know that when you order a cafe latte that is going to be made the same way every single time, and they're going to ask you your name on your order. And when you pick it up, they're going to call your name to get that order. Why is that important? Because Starbucks has built a level of consistency that people come to expect. Mm. And when people look at that store, that consistency is still there, which helps with their marketing. Individuals who want to really be great have to focus on not only working hard, but they also have to market themselves to be desirable. It's kind of a lesson in economics, really. Everyone in our society, a free market society, has the ability to be both a consumer and a producer. And if you really want to be successful, you have to be a productive producer. Part of being productive is being marketable, making people want to buy what you're selling.
Yeah, and again, when you're talking about this, it's not about self-exaltation. It's about being effective in the things that are set before us, effective in the areas that God has called us to. And Don, we're out of time, but you know what has blessed me since our first interaction was that following Jesus at any cost has been more important to you than anything else. And that rings through the book as well. Again, it's not because I'm better than you. You'll find it to be an easy, enjoyable read. Get a few copies for your friends as well, the author, Don Carey. Don, we're out of time, but there's so much you're doing outside of football, speaking to people, entrepreneur, great vision. And I know the same principles that got you this far will get you just into this next level that God's calling to you once you move on from football. So thanks so much for joining us, man. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
So thanks for having me. You have a great day.
All right. God bless you. Again, Don Carey, the book, It's Not Because I'm Better Than You. Only book I asked for the author to sign it and give it to one of my grandkids.